instantly made a move for the opening, but he blocked her with his arm.
You can look in, not that there is much to see.
Stevie craned her head into the pitch-black opening. Here, the stench of dust and mold was truly terrible, and she immediately sneezed. She got out her phone and shone it into the darkness. She could faintly make out a passageway, barely 2 feet wide, with a set of stairs at the end.
That's how Ellie got out? Stevie asked.
She took a hidden door from the office?
That's how she got out. She came down the steps, out through this doorway. Over here,
he indicated the window, there were a few boxes shoved up against the wall.
There were boxes just under the window. It was partially propped open.
Stevie stood for a moment, looking at the tiny window caked in old dirt and cobwebs. It was covered by a grate on the outside.
How?
She said. How did she know?
I don't know, Larry said. We've had people get into the basement, but no one, to my knowledge, ever found this passage before.
So she got out the window, Stevie said, looking up. How did she get through that grate?
They're hooked closed down here,
he said, pointing to a latch.
You undo the latch, push up. That's how we found it.
So she gets through the passage, comes downstairs, stacks some stuff, opens the window and the grate, and climbs out. She did this all in, what, 5 minutes?
Something like that.
So she had a 5-minute lead on you, and all of this must have taken a few minutes, so she only had a minute or two to run from the building before you went after her.
Give or take,
Larry said.
We went to the basement first. We had to scramble people, so yes, she had about a 5-minute head start.
Where do you think she went? Stevie said. She didn't have anything with her. I mean, she had her coat, but she had no money. I guess she had her phone?
No calls were made, and there's no trace of the phone. She turned it off or ditched it somewhere.
What do you think she did? Stevie asked.
Best guess? She made her way down to the road. We went down there right away, but she must have cut through the woods. The police looked at the rest stops on the highway, had eyes on the buses. Somehow she got past. I think she knows people in Burlington. Maybe one of them came and got her. That's my guess.
Not eaten by a bear? Stevie asked.
It's not impossible that she ran into a bear. But bear fatalities are rare, and we would have found some remains, most likely.
He said that a little too nonchalantly for Stevie's comfort.
I think she'll turn up, he said. Element's family had a history of living in communes. I think there are ways she could have gotten to one of those places, and she's lying low. Loads of places like that up and around here. But eventually, people come out. No one wants to stay hidden forever. It's not human nature.
No one wants to stay hidden forever. Can I ask you something? She said. Larry indicated that she had been doing this all along and might as well just keep going. How do guilty people act? Stevie asked.
They lie, generally,
Larry said.
Some fall apart right away, but some can keep lying to your face, cold as ice, and never stop.
But is there something they do? Is there some kind of tell?
Yes and no,
Larry said.
It's not them. It's you. Once you're around it enough, you learn how to spot it. But you can't rely on that. You have to go on the evidence. Even if you have the best instinct in the world, it's the facts that matter.
You can't rely on your gut, she said.
Not in determining guilt. But your gut can help you in other ways. It can keep you from getting hurt.
There was something just a little bit pointed in how he said it. Did Ellie seem guilty to you? She asked.
She seemed scared,
he said.
But she would have been.
A silence fell between them for a moment, filled with the remains of Ellie's fear.
Look,
Larry said.
We don't know what happened. But I tend to believe it was an accident, a prank gone wrong or something like that. For all I know, they worked on it together. Got the dry ice together. I think Element and Hayes were both kids who got into things they shouldn't. Whatever she did, whatever happened, I don't think she meant to do it. If she did it, she doesn't strike me as a dangerous person. You don't have to be afraid. And this place is wired now. There are perimeter lights, cameras, all the stuff I've been wanting for years. She's not going to come near you. I won't let her.
Stevie looked at Larry now and felt the sudden urge to cry. Something in her melted a bit. Was it gratitude? Pent-up fear? She balled her hands and turned back toward the dark side of the room, back at the dank basement labyrinth she was in. There were so many places to get lost in here, up here, in life. So many dark corners. Stevie turned back to the small window once more. It was just wide enough to wiggle through. The whole escape would have required such bravado. Ellie had kept her shit together. Larry indicated that she should return the way they had come, down the little path of lights. He pulled the cord and the chamber went dark. Only a bit of light came in through that window, like a dim, heavily lidded eye. As Stevie stepped out of the great house, she noticed there was something in the Neptune fountain that had not been there when she went in. David sat in it, the streams of water pouring from the open mouths of Neptune's mighty fish friends dumping onto his head, flattening his hair. "This is what they call attention-seeking behavior," she said, approaching him.
"They're going to turn it off for the winter soon," David replied, opening his mouth for a gulp of fountain water.
"Is that clean?" she said. "Should you be drinking it?"
He shrugged.
Then he stood, his clothes dripping, and climbed out of the fountain. He stuck his hands in the pockets of his shorts and walked along beside her, as if there was nothing unusual about what he had just done.
"Therapy," she said. "It works."
"I've tried it. They always end up crying. I think I've helped them have some real breakthrough moments." "You were in there a while. What were you up to?"
"Were you following me?"
"Not following," he said. "I just take an interest." "What were you doing?"
"Just looking," she said.
"At what?"
"The basement."
"What did you see?"
"A maze," she replied. "The basement is weird. But it's clear how Ellie got out. She went through the passage and then out the basement window."
"We know that,"
he said.
"My question is, what happened then?"
"I don't know the answer," she said. "I'm trying. You asked me to look. I'm looking."
David shivered a bit in his wet hoodie.
It wasn't proper fall weather yet, but it was definitely not the kind of day to be walking around in sopping wet clothes. Stevie couldn't help but take note of the fact that he was keeping track of her, and the fountain was done to impress her. And it was making an impression. It was bizarre. And he looked good wet.
"Well, look faster," he said.
"Polite conversation isn't hard," Edward King had said.
Even David's voice was a little like his father's. The words were different, but the timbre was the same. The King poison touched everything. "This isn't on me," she snapped.
"I didn't say it was," he replied. "It's just that time is passing."
"It's not my fault."
"I didn't say it."
"Well, you're acting like it," she said, walking off. It was amazingly easy to work herself into a state of indignation. She had to repel herself, not see David, not feel what she always felt around him. She had to drive the desire out of her. An argument was as good a way as any of distracting herself. But it only worked to a point. Also, she had to wonder, did David blame her for what happened? Did everyone?
11.
"Anatomy,"
Pix said, writing the word on the whiteboard,
"comes from the Greek. The prefix ana means apart. The root word tome is cutting. Dissection is Latin in origin. Dis means apart as well, and secare is the root word for cutting. So anatomy and dissection are linked in language and in practice. To understand how bodies work, you need to get in there and have a look."
Monday morning brought Stevie back to her first class, which was anatomy and physiology, taught by Pix. Anatomy was one of the things Stevie had looked most forward to studying at Ellingham. It was the kind of thing she would need to know. They had reached the dissection part of the program, which meant that they had moved into a lab. She had a new partner as well. Mudge, he of the colored contact lenses.
On that note, Pix said, come down here and get a dissection kit for each of your stations, along with a sheep heart.
Stevie reluctantly went down and got one of the trays, which was preset with scalpels, scissors, and probes. She reached into the cooler and removed one vacuum-packed sheep heart, which was a deep red, almost black.
You want to cut or diagram?
Mudge asked. Stevie looked at the heart. It looked like shrink-wrapped cooked beets. As much as she liked wearing the gloves, she was not enthused about this.
Draw, she said. Cool.
They both put on lab gloves, and Mudge picked up the heart and cut the package open.
You like anatomy? She asked.
I love it,
Mudge said.
You want to be a doctor?
I want to work at Disney World,
Mudge said. Stevie looked up at her lab partner, all 6.5 feet of him, with the dyed jet black hair, the purple snake eye contact lenses, and the spiked rings and bracelets.
What?
He said.
Disney World? She asked.
I love Disney World. Look.
He leaned down and pulled on the collar of his Slipknot t-shirt with his gloved fingers. There was a small object pinned to it. It was a Mickey Mouse enamel pin.
This is a retired 1-year service pin, he said. I collect them. I have about 100.
He stood back up.
It's why I don't have any tattoos, he said. Cast members can't have visible tattoos.
You want to be a cast member? Stevie said. Like, play Mickey?
All staff are called cast members, he said. I mean, eventually I want to be an Imagineer, but I'd like to start by working the park at the visitor level. What's the first incision?
As Stevie stepped out of the building, still smelling of dissection, she found David sitting, waiting for her, wearing a pair of sunglasses and looking smug.
Hello, Scooby, he said. Have you had any brainwaves?
Stevie had conferred with him the night before, saying that she had looked in the basement. The basement hadn't really advanced her knowledge.
I told you, she said. It seems clear she went down through the passage, grabbed some stuff to get up to the window, and then climbed out.
Which we know, he said. I guess I'm just surprised she didn't tell me there was an escape panel in the wall over at the Gray House. We shared that kind of thing.
Do you know other places? Stevie asked.
I know all kinds of things, he said with a smile. Maybe if you're good, I'll share. But the point is, how does she go out the window and then vanish into thin air? For all the reasons I said.
So what do you think? Stevie said, if you were her.
Maybe she hid that night, he said. That's been my feeling all along. I think she hid until she could figure out what to do. Lots of places she could have hid. But they locked shit down after that. That's what keeps getting me. No coat, no phone. I don't know. She used a phone somewhere. I just don't get it and can't get it. But I guess I should go to Calc.
You're going to Calc? Stevie said.
I make the occasional appearance, he replied. Keeps Shorty on his toes. Dr. Short loves me. Everyone loves me. I'm lovable.
He lifted his sunglasses and winked at her, then spun to head to class. What the hell did that mean? Clearly they were friends again, or David felt they were. She shook off her confusion and headed to the Great House. She had work to do. The Ellingham Attic was a place of true magic. It was perhaps the most private location on campus, this cavern above it all, its expanse as large as the footprint of the Great House. It was shrouded in half-light through the blinds. This is where the detritus of Ellingham life had ended up, here on all of these metal shelving racks. Stevie walked among them again, letting the quiet seep over her. It smelled faintly of dust, but this was a fine, storied dust, gently trapped in velvets, resting like new snow on mirrors. Everything here was trapped in time. A lot of it, Stevie remembered as she walked around to reacclimatize herself, was junk, really. Good junk, but junk. There were boxes of doorknobs, stacks of plates, boxes of old uniforms. Some things she had been wanting to revisit, like the aisle that contained the old items from Albert Ellingham's office, the things that hadn't really mattered enough to send on to any museum or archive. There were some telephones and cords, unused papers and slips. She dug into one of the boxes, where she had found the Western Union slip with the riddle that Albert Ellingham had written on the day he died. Where do you look for someone who's never really there? Always on a staircase, but never on a stair. She dug around in this box again, eyeing her notepad to see if anything Fenton wanted might be in here. The box contained things like paperweights, staples, old letterhead, some little boxes marked in Smith Corona typewriter ribbon, F.B. Bridges' fine quality pen tips, Webster Chicago recording wire, paper rolls for a Burroughs adding machine. All these products that must have been something once, something you'd find everywhere, that meant nothing now. They were obsolete. She sat down on the floor and read through the notepad that Fenton had given her. There were 307 items she wanted Stevie to check. Some would be relatively easy and quick, checking which rooms had connecting doors, confirming colors and materials and patterns. Some would require reading through the many volumes of household records. What struck Stevie was how mundane, even stupid, these details were. Or, at least, that's how they seemed. But detection, and maybe book writing, required research, and details mattered. She opened a document on her laptop and worked out a rough plan of attack, bundling the items into groups that she could search for at the same time. With a little effort, she got them into 7 lists grouped by type. This kind of work soothed her and got her out of her head. Break it down, put it in order, make a list. Soon, Fenton's sloppy notes were in a clean format. She decided to start on the first list right then and there, and pulled down several volumes of household records. The records contained all the daily workings of the Ellingham house, groceries and supplies ordered, meals served, tasks accomplished. Meat came on Mondays and Thursdays. Fish 4 times a week, and the dairy made massive deliveries every day. Oranges and lemons were special ordered from Florida in the winter. Groceries, vegetables, and household goods came in sometimes 3 times a day. Cleaning was a massive ongoing process. Aside from the regular house staff, local people came in by the truckload to scrub windows and patios, to polish the miles of rosewood, to dust the mountains of marble, to clean out fireplaces and cut and stack wood, to pack the ice houses, to repair anything that needed mending. There was the outdoor staff as well, a small army of gardeners to plant and weed and water and coax life out of the side of the mountain. All of this, plus the hundreds more who were working to finish the school. It became crystal clear just how much Ellingham Academy must have meant to the local people. Everyone must have worked there at one time or another. Everyone sold them things. Businesses depended on this strange man and his school in the middle of nowhere. It was so much effort for so few people, and at the same time, Albert Ellingham became the source of so much. An attack on him would have been an attack on everyone. It certainly made a kind of sense that someone would have wanted Anton Voracek dead. People would have known the family, depended on them. And so many people would have had a look at least part of the grounds. They would not have known the tunnels, but the iceman would have known the basement, the delivery man the kitchen, the cleaners would have seen the interior of the house. People talked. Stevie shut her computer and closed her eyes. A feather, a bit of beaded cloth, a lipstick, a pair of would-be gangsters. What did it all mean? Did Francis and Edward talk to someone? Did they work with someone from the outside? The answers were not available yet. She dusted herself off and glanced around again. There were old friends to visit. Somewhere around here was a box of newspapers that Albert Ellingham had buried in the tunnel. It had just been excavated. They might contain something useful. She could not find it. She went on to the end of the room, to the attic's greatest treasure. It was a massive mound, about 8 feet across, covered in a sheet. She pulled this off gingerly. Underneath was another great house, an exact copy. This had been made for Alice Ellingham after her disappearance. It sat here, gathering dust, waiting for her return. She reached around to find the latch and swung it open, examining the rooms inside as they had existed in the 1930s. There were cooks in the kitchen, working with tiny pots. Iris's bedroom was there, her bed made in small satin bed linens, her dresser set with little brushes and perfume bottles. Stevie looked down on the scene like a goddess, examining the old bedrooms, the rustic bathrooms with their tiny tiles. And there was Albert Ellingham's office, with copies of his chairs, his desks, his rugs, and even some of the very things she had just been looking at. There was even a doll of him. Stevie picked him up. The jointed china bent to her will. His face was painted with a benevolent smile. There was something profoundly disturbing about the dollhouse. Perhaps that was why it had never been displayed. It was getting darker now. The attic had fallen into shadow. It was probably time to go to dinner. She replaced the doll. On her way out, she looked out the west-facing window toward the maintenance shed and the small faculty parking lot. There were just two very expensive cars down there. Dr. Quinn was walking toward one of them, a red sports car of some kind, switching out her glasses. It seemed fitting that she would drive something that looked like it should be zipping along some European mountain road, or perhaps the coastline of Nice. But the parking lot was not the real view. From here, she could see into the far distance. The mountains. What had it taken to build this place? To take an unbroken mountaintop that no one could live on and build a tiny empire. Albert Ellingham was obsessed with gods and goddesses. Was he trying to make his own Olympus? To own a piece of earth and sky? Her phone buzzed in her pocket and she pulled it out. It was a text from an unknown number. Hope things are going well. E.K. Edward King. Just letting her know that he was here. That he was keeping tabs. The text felt as palpable as a hand on the shoulder. She had not given him her number, but that was the whole point. He was telling her he did not need to ask for this information. It was his to take. "You want to play?" she asked the phone. But she had no move to make against him. The only thing she could do was work down this list, keep working her leads. He didn't own her. He had simply borrowed a part of her. That was what she was going to keep telling herself. 12. Halloween, the season and then the date, crept slowly up on the Ellingham campus. The scenery was repainted each evening, the leaves more gold than green. Some of the vines that snaked up the buildings turned a shocking red. Pumpkins began to appear in windows and doorways and nooks. The nights reached into the days with long fingers, dragging back time. Stevie fell back into the ways of Ellingham, and Ellingham fell back into her. Her room felt more snug. It smelled more familiar. Of her comforter and Ellingham laundry detergent, they had a service. Your laundry went out dirty in a bag and came back clean and folded. Like the old smoke from the fire in the common room. She tried to catch up with her classes, and for maybe a week she believed that she might even be able to do it. This confidence largely came from a one-night sprint doing Spanish modules until 3 in the morning. The burst left her feeling academic, maybe brilliant, maybe an unsung genius of her time. The euphoria came crashing down when she realized she was missing entire systems in anatomy, was 4 novels behind in English, and her history paper on the Harding presidency was something that would never really be written. Its existence was a little concept joke. She had, however, made progress with Fenton's requests. She had been doing long hours in the attic, going over the tedium of the list. Stevie did not know she could be bored by details about the Ellingham case, but Fenton had accomplished it. Now, on Halloween morning, she was on the coach again, returning with the first properly completed piece of work she had done at her entire time at Ellingham. It was good to do something, right? Before going to Burlington, Stevie had to assure Janelle that she would be back in time for that night's Halloween party. Stevie had always been Halloween ambivalent. There were many positive things about Halloween. True crime shows always got an extra bump. Other shows pulled out their murder mystery episodes, and slinking around in the dark was generally more acceptable. But she could never get on board with the costumes. There was the first problem, being cute. That had been the message her whole life. As a child, Halloween was that day Stevie was stuffed into a Disney princess outfit against her will.
"You look so cute,"
her mom would say, as she safety pinned the thin polyester bell dress to the layer of warm clothes she had on underneath.
"Don't you want to be a princess?"
Stevie did not want to be a princess. She was not sure what princesses were or what they did. She asked to be a different princess, like Princess Leia, but this was rejected. The reason was never given. Stevie pointed to every costume in the store. A ghost, a pirate, a banana. It was no use. It was the Disney princess every time, the same costumes pulled out over and over. It was an understood thing that Janelle Franklin took Halloween very seriously. She had organized and planned for it with the same precision and attention to detail that she applied to everything in her life. Stevie had watched her construct a Wonder Woman costume piece by piece for a week, sewing, applying, cutting foam, spray painting, and hot gluing. More than once, she had called Stevie in for help, and during these times, she had grilled Stevie on what she was going to be. She did not accept Stevie's answer of someone who stays at home and does not wear a costume. "Halloween is a chance to be whatever you want to be," Janelle said as Stevie hot glued a foam piece in the form of a gold W to a corset that Janelle was wearing. "It doesn't have to be all sexy sexy. That's patriarchal bullshit. I'm Wonder Woman because I love Wonder Woman. Who do you love?"
"The people who work at DNA databases," Stevie said, checking to make sure the W was secure.
"Okay. How about detectives? What about Sherlock Holmes?"
Stevie rolled her eyes.
"What's wrong with Sherlock Holmes?"
Janelle asked. "Nothing is wrong with Sherlock Holmes," Stevie said, "but he's not a costume. He's..." Stevie waved her hands in the air to try to convey that you didn't just dress up like the world's greatest fictional detective, the one upon whom real-world detection techniques were based, and no, it wasn't about the hat or the coat. Janelle guided her hand back carefully because Stevie was still holding a hot glue gun.
"Name another one," Janelle said.
"I don't know.
Hercule Poirot." "Good," Janelle said. "Fine, do that."
Stevie's costume budget was basically $10, and less if she could manage it. The school permitted students to use the costumes at the theater. There, Stevie had found a suit that, if not entirely up to the exacting standards of Belgium's neatest detective, was good enough. She would slick back her hair and wear a hat. Vi had a can of dark spray that they would let Stevie use. She had bought the mustache online. She set all these things out on her bed on Saturday morning before getting on the coach to go to her meeting. Tonight, she had to play the part of detective. Now, she had to go try to be one. Fenton lived in the middle of Burlington, in the university area. The street she lived on was full of big Victorian houses that were likely once the homes of rich families. They had big wraparound porches that faced toward Lake Champlain. The university had taken over some of the fine brick buildings and made them into university property. The others, the big rambling ones painted all kinds of colors, had been divided up into apartments for students, who put coolers and rocking chairs and hammocks on the porches and hung banners and tapestries in the windows. Her house was a tiny, sage green one between a fraternity and a deli. It had a big screened-in front porch. This was filled with piles of newspapers, milk crates, and a lot of recycling. There was a theme in the recycling, Stevie noted. There were a lot of bottles in it. Many wine bottles, two whiskey bottles, a vodka bottle. She remembered Hunter picking up Fenton's mug and examining it. This gesture suddenly made a lot more sense. There was music blasting inside, so Stevie had to knock for almost a full minute on the peeling green door before it opened. Fenton answered, an unlit cigarette in her mouth. Today she wore an old pair of mom jeans and a baggy black sweater.
Hey,
she said, shooing a big orange cat back inside with her bare foot.
Come in.
Somehow, Fenton's house was everything Stevie knew it would be, and yet it still surprised her. The house smelled like cigarette smoke and cat and trash and a single scented candle that was probably supposed to cover all that but only made it worse. They had entered a living room that was mostly composed of books. Books on shelves, books in stacks along the wall, books all over a round table in the middle of the room. Books scattered on seats. There was a large television and a cabinet full of DVDs. There were glasses and mugs everywhere. Things in tinfoil that she could not identify. There were also some things that were likely Hunter's. A coat, some sneakers, some books on the environment. As she scanned the room, she spotted two more cats hiding out in the scenery. The smell hung over it all. Stevie tried not to show it, but she couldn't help but shield her nose.
Something wrong, Fenton said over the music.
No, it's...
Fenton turned off the music and the silence was abrupt. You like the Rolling Stones?
She asked.
I... Best band in the world. Exile on Main Street. Best album in the world. No arguments.
Does something stink?
Hunter tells me that all the time. I lost my sense of smell years ago. Open a window if something smells off. Come into my office.
Fenton put the unlit cigarette behind her ear and waved Stevie through a set of French doors covered in bamboo blinds. This room took things to a new level. The majority of the room was taken up by a massive walnut desk with a shaded green lamp. There was a much-used leather chair in the corner. There were books in here as well, kept in low, orderly stacks. These were interspersed with large cardboard file boxes and metal file cabinets. But it was the walls that really captured her attention. One wall was full of black and white photographs of people known to be in the house on the day of the kidnapping. There was a whole section of photos of Voracek. Then photos of the house and grounds. Then maps, new and old. The one closest to Stevie was made of thin, frail paper but was in very good condition, showing the highways of Vermont in blocky blue ink. Several pushpins were in this map.
Original road map, printed in 1935,
Fenton said. It was a conspiracy wall. A true, real conspiracy wall. The only things missing were the bits of string that connected the various points.
So, Fenton said, how did we do?
Stevie pushed over the notepad.
I have 290 out of 307, Stevie said. A few things were missing. I couldn't find the one China pattern you wanted.
Fenton hummed and flipped through the pad, rolling one of her gray spiral curls around her finger.
Let me read through this, she said. Go and get yourself a Coke or something in the kitchen.
Fenton waved Stevie off. Stevie went back through the living room, stopping to pet a big ginger cat on one of the sofas. The sofa was thick with cat hair, almost to the point where the color of the sofa was obscured. There were traces of cat litter around the floor, along with ash and specks of paper. Every exposed surface had water rings on it. She had a feeling that the kitchen would not be a pleasant experience, but some effort had been made. There were many dirty glasses, but they were clustered together by the sink. There were some empty wine bottles and a pizza box on the floor by the trash. Nothing good would come of opening the refrigerator. Stevie came from an uptight family, where the slightest smell or stain or smudge in the kitchen was unacceptable, and she just knew that there would be a smell in this fridge from something incorrectly sealed and outdated. There were, however, some warm Cokes in a box on the floor. Stevie took one, opened it, and wiped the top of the can with her sleeve before sipping. She glanced through the pile of books on the table and had just opened one about the Yorkshire Ripper when she heard the door open.
Hey!
Called a voice. She leaned over to look and saw Hunter coming in the door, leaning his crutch against the wall and dropping his backpack to remove his puffer coat. Stevie leaned back in, feeling weird about being in his house, drinking his warm Coke, even though she was allowed to be here.
I couldn't get any limes, he said, but I bought some lunch meat.
He came into the kitchen and blinked in surprise.
Hey, he said. Oh, hey, sorry.
Hi.
Hunter! Fenton yelled.
Yeah?
Get Stevie a Coke!
Hunter smirked in gentle embarrassment and nodded at the Coke Stevie was holding.
Sorry, he said. It's kind of a mess in here. Are you working?
Your aunt is going through some stuff I did.
Oh, cool.
Hunter looked around as if he was sorry for intruding in his own house. There was something sunny about Hunter. He had light hair. The cut was a little too short, probably a cheap and fast one, or maybe a home job. His smattering of freckles made him look younger than he was.
So, he said, sitting down. What's Ellingham like?
Intense, she said.
Really good.
A lot.
So how did you get in?
I just wrote about how I was obsessed with the case, she said. I didn't think they'd take me. Someone liked me, though.
I guess you have the something, he said.
Actually, I applied.
I didn't get my letter from Hogwarts.
She realized for the first time that she was an insider to others who might have wanted to go there, wanted to have this magic. She was to be envied. It was weird, and not entirely comfortable, and she wanted to say something to make Hunter feel better, but she knew that if someone had said something to her in that position, she would have taken it as being patronizing.
It's okay, he said. I wasn't hanging on it or anything. I just knew about it because of my aunt, and I took a shot.
He smirked and glanced around as if embarrassed by everything he was saying.
I still think I was a mistake, Stevie said.
Everyone must say that.
No one says that, Stevie said, but me. It may be true. My friend Janelle is a genius. My friend Nate is an author. Everyone's something there.
And you're something, he said.
I like crime, she said.
Who doesn't?
He said, smiling. Lots of people.
Stupid people, he said.
This made her smile.
Good work.
Fenton was standing in the doorway.
You did this a lot faster than I expected. My lazy-ass grad students would have taken all semester. Come on.
Hunter grimaced just a bit, and Stevie got up to follow Fenton back to her office. Once inside, Fenton shut the double doors and then sat and looked Stevie over.
You're serious, she said. I like that. I thought we were going to be screwing around, but all right. Maybe we can do some real work together.
Stevie wondered what she had just spent a week doing if it was not real work.
First rule, Fenton said, pointing at the wall of document boxes. Don't put your stuff on the internet. Once you put it online, it's worthless. It's not yours.
She took the cigarette from behind her ear and lit it with a lighter from her desk.
I assume you've read the Vorchek court transcript.
Of course, Stevie said.
That was one of the first things anyone interested in the case did. Fenton pulled out a bound copy with what looked like 100 post-it notes flagging from the side. She licked her thumb and opened it to a blue noted page.
Here, she said. Read from the highlighted lines.
It was the testimony of Marion Nelson, the housemistress of Minerva. These were the lines Fenton had highlighted.
Prosecution. Miss Nelson, can you tell us when you first realized Dolores Epstein was missing?
Marion Nelson.
It was right after 9 that night.
Prosecution.
9 at night? Isn't that late for a young girl to be out?
M.N.
Well, no, not at Ellingham. One of the precepts of the school is that the children have freedom to learn and explore. The school seemed, and generally is, very safe. So they can read, play, experiment, study. Dottie was a voracious reader, and she would often hide away somewhere with a book. But generally, she would appear for supper.
Prosecution.
And she did not.
M.N.
No.
Prosecution.
When did you first learn that she was missing?
M.N.
When Mr. Ellingham's men came to the door at dawn and told us to get the children packed and ready to leave.
Now. Fenton said, taking the transcript back and turning to a later page, to testimony from July 22, 1938, from Margot Fields, the local telephone operator who connected the ransom calls. Fenton had highlighted more lines.
Prosecution.
Miss Fields, you were working at the telephone exchange in Burlington on April 13, 1936. Is this correct?
Margot Fields.
Yes, I was, yes, at work, yes.
Prosecution.
How long have you been a telephone operator, Miss Fields?
M.F. 6 years this June. I started as soon as I left high school. I didn't know what I wanted to do, but there was an opening, and I applied for it, and I got it, and I've been doing it ever since.
Prosecution.
What can you tell us about the telephone lines going to Ellingham Academy?
M.F. Oh, there are a lot of them. There are 7 lines going into the house, and then a lot of the buildings have their own telephones. There are 16 lines going to the property in total.
Prosecution.
7 lines go into the main house?
M.F. Yes. I didn't know a phone could have 7 phone lines until Mr. Ellingham came along. Imagine, 7 telephones in one house.
Prosecution.
Can you tell us where the lines go?
M.F.
Well, one goes to Mr. Montgomery. He's the butler. There's one to the kitchen. There's one to Mr. McKenzie. He's Mr. Ellingham's secretary. One to Mrs. Ellingham. There's a guest telephone and a housekeeper's telephone. And then, of course, there's Mr. Ellingham's telephone. Most of the calls to the house or going out of it go to Mr. Montgomery or Mr. McKenzie or Mrs. Ellingham. Unless there's a party up there, then the calls come and go from all the phones all day. And the calls that go into Mr. Ellingham's telephone, they come and go from all over.
Prosecution.
Let's go to the afternoon of April 13th, Miss Fields. When do you get to work?
M.F.
Well, that day I was doing a shift starting at 5 p.m. I have lunch at Henry's before I do that shift. So I sat down at my station at 5 p.m. and took over from Helen Woolman.
Prosecution.
I'm entering into evidence Exhibit 56A, Your Honor. Miss Fields, is this the logbook you use to record calls?
M.F.
It is.
Prosecution.
Can you tell us about the telephone call you connected at 7:15 that evening?
M.F.
Yes, I can. That phone call came from a telephone booth on College and Church Streets. They called Mr. Montgomery's telephone. I don't see many calls coming from telephone booths going to the Ellingham house, but that's right by the market, so I thought it might be a delivery or some such. But I was curious, you know.
Prosecution.
Can you describe the voice on the line?
M.F.
Rough. Very rough, with a strange way of speaking. He sounded like he was speaking through a tube or something. That telephone can have a funny connection, though.
Prosecution.
Was there anything else about the voice? How was it strange?
M.F.
Oh, it had an accent.
Prosecution.
What kind of accent?
M.F.
Not American. European, I think. My neighbor, Mrs. Czarnecki, from down the street, she's from Warsaw in Poland, and it sounded a bit like her, but not quite. I stayed on the line just long enough to hear Mr. Montgomery answer. I wish I'd hung on, but we don't do that. Oh, I wish I had. You don't know how I wish I had. I don't know what I would have done.
Prosecution.
How long did that call last?
M.F.
5 or 6 minutes.
Prosecution.
What happened after that?
M.F.
The next call was outgoing. This was at 7:45. Mr. McKenzie telephoned out and asked to be connected to... That would be George Marsh. That's another common call. After that, Mr. McKenzie called me back and asked me to make a special note of where all calls coming in and out of the house came from that evening. He sounded a bit funny, but he said something about Mr. Ellingham just needing to know for some business reason. And he asked where the previous call had come from, and I told him. I usually go on a half-hour dinner break at 7 in the evening, but I ate my sandwich at my station because Mr. McKenzie had asked me to pay special attention, and we always take care of the Ellingham lines. He's done so much for those children. I remember I had a cheese and tomato jam sandwich, and a call came in as soon as I took a bite.
Prosecution.
What can you tell us about the other calls?
M.F.
All right. I've recorded here that at 8:03 p.m. there was an incoming call from New York City that went to Mrs. Ellingham's personal telephone. That was unanswered. I didn't know why then, but I do now, of course. That was from a Manhattan exchange, a line I saw often. I think it's a friend of hers.
Prosecution.
That call was identified as being from Mrs. Rose Peabody, and she was a friend of Mrs. Ellingham.
M.F.
Yes, there was nothing really new about that call. Now, the next call, that was incoming from another telephone booth, which was odd. This was at 8:47. This was a telephone by the gasoline station as you go out on Route 2. Do you know that one? That call was to Mr. McKenzie's line. Now, this was the same strange voice as the first call. I'm sure of it. Very rough. I stayed on long enough to hear Mr. McKenzie pick it up. There was another call at 9:50 to Mrs. Ellingham's line, the same number from New York City, Mrs. Peabody, and it went unanswered. I went off duty at midnight, and I called Mr. McKenzie to tell him so, and I read off the information to him. Prosecution.
Those were the only calls?
M.F. Yes. Prosecution.
Coming in, going out, even between the buildings?
M.F. Some days the Ellingham lines are very busy, but the evenings are generally quieter. And I think Mr. Ellingham was in town that day, so his phones were quieter. So it wasn't that odd. Prosecution.
The voice you heard. Could you identify it if you heard it again?
M.F. I think I could. I might. It was a strange voice. There was something wrong with it. Prosecution.
Something wrong?
M.F. I can't explain it. Prosecution.
But you think you would know it?
M.F. I think I might. Prosecution.
Your Honor, I'd like to ask the defendant, Mr. Anton Voracek, to read something out loud.
Defense.
Objection, Your Honor.
Judge Ladsky. I'll allow it.
Prosecution.
Mr. Voracek, I've written something on this piece of paper. I'd just like you to read it in your normal speaking voice.
Anton Voracek.
I am not an actor. I won't be in your play.
Judge Ladsky.
You are out of order, Mr.
Anton Voracek.
This court is a farce. You are all puppets of the capitalist state.
Judge Ladsky.
Mr. Voracek, I am on the verge of having you removed from the courtroom.
Prosecution.
Your Honor, that may be enough for my purposes. Miss Fields, you've just heard Mr. Voracek's voice. Was that the voice you heard?
M.F. Ah, voices are strange. You hear so many of them down the lines and you pick up little things and you think you can pick them apart, but then they all go back together again. I just got the feeling that this person didn't want to be understood. It was such a terrible night. I didn't know that then, of course, but after. But, yes, I think maybe yes. Prosecution.
No further questions, Your Honor.
Stevie knew better than to say, what about it?
She looked to Fenton for a clue as to where this was going.
She says that there were no other calls from 9:50 to midnight, Fenton said. And Miss Nelson says that she found out about the kidnapping in the morning. So, I did a little checking.
There was a pile of yellow legal pads on the corner of the desk. She sorted through the stack until she got the one she wanted.
I told you I had some new information, Fenton said. I talked to a lot of people. I got some very interesting, very important information. One of the people I found was Gertie Van Kuvorden.
Gertie Van Kuvorden was a student from Minerva, she said.
Right. A very rich one. One who liked to talk about that night to anyone who would listen. I interviewed her and recorded it and transcribed it. Here's what she said. It was a terrible night, so foggy. We were all of us gathered in the common room. We were all such good friends in Minerva, and we cared about each other so much. Dottie hadn't come home, and we were all so worried about her. Dottie was one of my dearest friends. Something was wrong, and I kept saying to Miss Nelson, our housemistress, that someone should be looking for her. I was thinking about doing it myself, but then the phone rang upstairs. Miss Nelson went to answer it. It was right before 10 in the evening because there was a radio program we liked to listen to that came on at 10 o'clock, but Miss Nelson made us all go to bed, and she started acting very strange. Fenton looked up from the pad. There's no mention of connecting a phone call at 10 o'clock, Fenton said. So then I look again at what Margot Fields actually says. Prosecution. Coming in, going out, even between the buildings. And Margot Fields doesn't say, yeah, that's right, She says something totally different. She says, some days the Ellingham lines are very busy, but the evenings are generally quieter, and I think Mr. Ellingham was in town that day so his phones were quieter, so it wasn't that odd. Which is not actually an answer. So, what do we have?
A discrepancy, Stevie said.
Gertie Van Kooforden says that there was a call and the records say there wasn't.
And we have a telephone operator who is being evasive on the stand. She isn't lying if she moves around the topic.
So which story is correct, do you think?
Gertie Van Kooforden with her phone call, or the evasive phone operator?
Stevie sat back and spun this around in her mind.
Why didn't anyone notice what Gertie said about a phone call before? She asked.
Fenton smiled and tapped a finger alongside her nose.
Exactly the right question. Because no one ever asked her. They seem to have gone to great lengths not to ask anyone in Minerva House about phone calls. And Gertie Van Kooforden did not strike me as being one of the nation's great thinkers. I don't think she noticed that the phone call was missing from the accounts of things. But I did.
So what does it mean? Someone called Minerva? That makes sense. They'd be looking for Dottie.
Right again, Fenton said. So why does the record of this phone call not exist?
The answer is in the building plan of Ellingham Academy. She went to the wall of black and white photos of the house and grounds.
You know there are tunnels up there, right? You've been in the most famous one, but there are others. Many have been partially earthed in or sealed for safety, but the whole point of secret tunnels was that they were secret, personal use. According to Gertie, there was a tunnel in Minerva.
In Minerva? Stevie said. I live in Minerva.
Any word of a tunnel there?
Nothing that I've heard.
Gertie was convinced of it. She said another student found it, that she had seen this student disappear and reappear.
Where does it go?
If my guess is right, it goes to somewhere on the other side of the campus, somewhere secluded, sort of over here.
She got up and pointed to the area down near the cafeteria and the gym.
So if we find this tunnel, Stevie said, where does it get us?
I have a little theory, Fenton said. If I can prove the tunnel exists, my theory is more likely.
What's the theory? Stevie said.
For me to know, but if I'm right, and this book turns out the way I think it will, you'll have been a part of it. There's your assignment. See about that tunnel. Scout around.
Stevie decided not to mention that tunneling was kind of frowned upon. Best to leave that alone. She had just been given an official assignment.
Hunter was sitting in the living room as they walked out, petting a big orange cat on his lap.
All done? He said. You need a ride, or?
Leave her alone, Fenton snapped. They have a coach.
Fenton sneezed, then yanked a copy of her book off a pile of what looked like old copies.
Here, she said, for you.
Stevie had one already, and this one had yellowed edges, but she accepted it. Fenton went off to the kitchen, their exchange finished.
I just meant if you needed one, Hunter said. Sorry, she's abrupt.
No, it's fine, Stevie said. They don't let people come up to campus anyway.
Oh, right.
His cheeks flushed a bit.
Yeah, stupid, sorry.
Don't be sorry, she said.
Look,
he said.
Is it weird if I give you my phone number? Just since you're working with my aunt and...
He looked toward the kitchen where Fenton was humming loudly.
You may want it, or you may not.
Sure,
Stevie said, offering her phone. He wasn't sure why he was giving her his number. Whether it was the smile he had given her before, or the erratic nature of Fenton that suggested that something was not quite right with this whole arrangement.
It was a phone number, in any case. Someone else to connect with.
It wasn't the worst feeling. 13. At 6 that evening, as the day drew to a close and the shadows fell over Ellingham, Stevie Bell stood in her room, tucking herself into the suit that still smelled strongly of mothballs and must from the costume attic. She stood before the mirror and did what the famously fastidious Belgian detective would do.
She adjusted her mustache until it was perfect. She tucked a pillow into her front to fill out her belly a bit and take up some of the extra space in the baggy suit. She'd found a walking stick prop and some white gloves, and the overall effect was pleasing. This tunnel stuff was stupid. If there was a tunnel under Minerva, someone would have found it by now. David, Ellie, someone. It would have loomed large in the legend. Still, a passable effort would need to be made. Hercule would look. The source of the tunnel would have to be on the first floor. This meant the possible entry points were the kitchen, the common room, the hallway, either one of the two bathrooms, or any of the three bedrooms. She had already crawled all over Ellie's floor. There was no evidence of a tunnel in there. Of course, entrances could be carefully hidden, but still. She got down and examined her floor, crawling, tapping, picking at the boards. Nothing. She could check Janelle's room later. Janelle was deep into her Wonder Woman transformation and could not be disturbed. But it seemed unlikely that the bedrooms were the source. The entry would have to be through the floor. She went to the kitchen, poking into the back of the cabinets with her stick. It was possible the refrigerator or the stove or dishwasher could have been covering the opening. But then, surely these spots had been checked. You needed to hook these things up with water and gas. The refrigerator was heavy. A hollow spot under it would likely have been found. She walked around the common room, looking at the flagstone floor. This was a more promising area, as any one of these stones could be a hatch. But it certainly appeared that the seals were tight. Similarly, the bathrooms showed no sign of having a passage anywhere in the floor. It was a perfunctory check, and she would look more later, but it really seemed that Fenton had to be wrong. Maybe there was a tunnel somewhere on the campus that had not been found, but it probably wasn't here. She was crawling down the hallway, examining the boards, when Nate came up behind her.
"What are you doing?"
he asked. Stevie stood up and adjusted her pillow stomach. "Nothing," she said. "Thought I dropped something. Is that your costume?" Nate was wearing his normal clothes, his grayed-out cords and a loose t-shirt.
"I don't do costumes," he said.
Janelle's door swung open, and Wonder Janelle stood in the doorway.
"You think you're getting away with that?" she said to Nate.
"I guessed this was going to happen." She reached behind her door and plucked out a long gray cloak made of some coarse material, a wizard hat of a similar color, and a gray beard. She extended the outfit in his direction. Nate stared and did not move.
"You just had that there?"
he asked. "eBay," she said, "and a little sewing. Take it." Nate took the costume and put it over his arm. "And here." She reached back again and produced a tree branch that had been roughly fashioned into a staff.
"How?"
he said. "Listen to me," Janelle said. "A lot of bad things have happened this year. It's been scary and sad and horrible. But we're here, and this is a holiday, which means we are going to celebrate because not everyone from this house can do that. So put on this wizard stuff. Let me fix my tiara, and we go." She shut her door.
"She's had this," Nate said, "all along."
"She's Janelle. She can see around corners. Are you going to wear it?" Nate felt the material between his fingers, then picked up the staff and examined it.
"It's a pretty good Gandalf outfit," he said. "I guess she made this staff. Like she went out and found a branch."
"Because she's Janelle," Stevie said. They went to the common room and Nate started to slip into the robes. There was the creak of footsteps moving overhead. Janelle stepped out of her room, her tiara now perfectly in place, with a round shield on her back and a sword in her hand. She regarded Nate with a satisfied nod.
"Good," she said. "Team Minerva. Where's David?"
There was a patter of steps and the ungodly creak of the stairs. Then, out of the dark of the hall, he emerged.
"Oh," Janelle said. "That's... you did the..."
The words were dying in Stevie's mouth.
"Sherlock thing."
David had, in fact, done the Sherlock thing that Stevie had dismissed for herself, specifically the BBC one. He was wearing a sharply cut blue dress shirt, slender, tailored pants, and a long gray-black coat with a red interior. He had teased out his hair a bit